All right, next item on our docket is 5-25-0895, Powers v. Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, et al. I have Attorney Smith for the appellant and Attorney Neumeister for the appellee. I'll give you time to get set up, obviously, but just making sure everyone's here. Take a moment, as much time as you need, and whenever you're ready, we'll begin. All right, Mr. Smith, are you prepared to proceed? All right, if you would step forward and state your name for the record, and you may proceed when you're ready. Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Stephon Smith, and I am the attorney for Appellant Renee Powers. This case stems from an indication of Ms. Powers at Brightside Academy in Paris, Illinois, which is in Edgar County. I'm sure the court is familiar with the facts, but Ms. Powers was indicated for DCFS allegation number 14. DCFS allegation number 14 requires certain specific conduct to take place that just did not occur. The allegation number 14 is defined as follows. Tying close confinement, which is the unreasonable restriction of a child's mobility, actions, or physical functioning, by tying the child to a fixed or heavy object, tying limbs together, or forcing the child to remain in a closely confined area that restricts physical movement. Examples include, but are not limited to, locking a child in a closet or small room, tying one or more limbs to a bed, chair, or other object, except as authorized by a licensed physician, tying a child's hands behind his or her back, putting a child in a cage, locking or blocking exits with the intention of preventing the child's ability to escape in case of an emergency. So in this case, the definition includes the word tying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times. So if you compare the conduct of Renee Powers to the definition of the allegation, Ms. Powers' conduct doesn't meet the specific definition, the specific elements of the allegation. Therefore, DCFS has made an error. DCFS made a mistake because there's no evidence whatsoever that Ms. Powers engaged in the conduct that the definition of the allegation calls for.
So, Counselor, it was the classroom aide that actually did the physical tying of the children.
That's correct.
Did the child's aide, though, work at the direction of the classroom teacher, Ms. Powers, in doing so, or not?
Well, there's no evidence that Ms. Powers directed the aide to tie any student to a chair with a pair of leggings. There's no evidence that she made that type of direction in the record. But, Your Honor, to answer your question, the issue of responsibility for the classroom has come up because my client was...
I'm going to interrupt you, though, Counsel.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the appellee's brief, and they, on their brief on page 24, they are citing the record, and they say that Powers admitted to Loy that she led the children to the chair for Hill to tie them up. Are you disputing that?
I'm not disputing that she led the children to the chair.
Okay.
I'm not disputing that.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you.
But I will say this, Your Honor, on that point. Leading the children to the chair and knowing what was going to happen, That doesn't fit the definition of the allegation. I'll go further on that point. DCFS has or had the opportunity to indicate Ms. Powers for a different allegation that would have fit her conduct. And that allegation was allegation number 60, entitled Environment Injurious to Health and Welfare. All right? And under that definition, it reads, environment injurious means that a child's environment creates a likelihood of harm to the child's health, physical well-being, or welfare, and that the likely harm to the child is a result of blatant disregard of parent or caretaker responsibilities. This allegation shall be used when the type or extent of harm is undefined, but the totality of the circumstances, including inculpatory and exculpatory evidence, leads a reasonable person to believe that the child's environment may likely cause harm to the child's health, physical well-being, or welfare due to the parent or caretaker's blatant disregard. Now, you have a question?
Well, I don't disagree with you, counsel, that there could have been other allegations or indicated findings that they could have used that perhaps would have been easier for DCFS to prove, right?
Right.
But does that negate the fact that allegation 14, how are they still not meeting their burden in allegation 14?
They haven't met their burden because they haven't established evidence on the elements of the allegation. DCFS has the burden by a preponderance of the evidence to establish credible evidence against each element of the allegation. So in this case, Renee Powers, she would have in fact had to engage in the act of tying to meet that definition. She didn't do it. She just didn't do it. And, Your Honor, DCFS has a mechanism to fix this. All they have to do, as I put in my reply brief, they can contact JCAR, amend the definition of the allegation to include other conduct, participation, involvement. This is something that DCFS has had the power to do. They didn't do it, and they made a mistake in this case. Okay? And that's that. Now, just to go further about Ms. Powers.
Excuse me, Attorney Smith, let me bring you back to the thrust of what argument you're making here. You're making the argument, basically, a very strict interpretation of the language, tying.
Yes.
That the only way that she, that the Ms. Powers could be culpable here is within that strict definition. Taking me back to the big picture about what our role is here, how does that tie into what our role is here and the review that we have to do? Make that connection for me, whether they did or they did not, or it's not strict definition. Give me the steps how it presents a basis for judgment on our part.
Right. So, if this court is a strict constructionist of the language of the allegation, the court is going to look at whether or not the evidence, well, whether or not DCFS made an error, or whether the evidence in the record is against the manifest weight of the evidence. And I think that both of those standards apply. I think this is a case of this is a mixed question of law and a mixed question of fact. So I think that for the court, when you compare what Ms. Powers did to the definition of the allegation, if we were to put a prosecutorial hat on and draw, like, if this was a crime, you look at the elements of the crime. Her conduct doesn't meet the elements of the crime. And that's been our allegation from day one. That's where the error occurred. That's why we filed this appeal.
And so you're not allowing for any type of assistance or abetting, any kind of a broadening of it beyond just the strict physical act of tying, correct?
No, Judge, because there's a different allegation for that. That's allegation number 60. So if DCFS would have indicated her for allegation number 60, which is creating an environment injurious to the health and welfare of the student, we wouldn't have brought this appeal, okay? DCFS is the answer.
We wouldn't have the appeal if she would have been alleged as, I think it was Ms. Hill was, which was a physical abuse of a child and didn't result in any of this. And Powers was alleged to have been culpable under this section that says tying. So it's kind of relevant to me as to what they could have done, because that's not what's up for review here by this court.
I didn't hear that.
It's not relevant to us what they could have done.
Right.
It may not be fair that they charged Ms. Hill differently with a different outcome, but that's not what's before the court. I'm just saying, how do we get to our review that presents itself here, either by saying we're reviewing not the circuit court, but the director's decision.
Right.
So you're saying the director's decision is against the manifest weight of the evidence because the underlying proof was not available, not presented.
That's absolutely right. And again, Your Honor, I represent Renee Powers. I don't represent Amy Hill. Amy Hill is a co-defendant. And we're here before Your Honors because Ms. Powers didn't engage in the act of tying, nor do we feel that her conduct was abuse under the Abused and Neglected Child Reporting Act. Now, we can also get into that because that's an element. The director of DCFS, before they can indicate, they also have to find abuse. So let's talk about abuse. Abuse deals with I've got the definition here. Okay. Under the statute, Ms. Powers would have had to engage in conduct that would have created a substantial risk of injury to abuse the child. Okay? First of all, she wasn't the person that had the leg. So the only thing she did was lead a child to the chair. Okay, that's not that her conduct is not abuse under the statute. We're dealing with a set of polka dot leggings as well. A piece of cloth, okay? Fixed object. I don't want to forget about that. The definition of the allegation talks about tying a child to a fixed object.
Yeah, but counsel, I think the ALJ in their order went into detail regarding the fact that the school code is outlawed restraining children. So doesn't by its very nature that the fact that the children were restrained create an allegation of abuse? I mean, isn't abuse sort of inherent in that in light of the school code and the outlawing of restraints?
Not from Ms. Powers. From Ms. Hill, but not from Ms. Powers.
Okay. And I want to go back to the standard of review. It's manifest weight as to the evidence, correct? But in terms of the court's or the ALJ's decision, it's clearly erroneous would be the standard. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. I don't have anything else.
Anything further? Any questions? Wait. Any questions, Justice Hackett?
None at this time.
You'll have time on rebuttal as well, okay. Counsel.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. All right, Mr. Neumeister. Yes, thank you, and good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Dave Neumeister on behalf of the department and its director. Powers didn't tie the knot. It's important to note that that's the only reason that she argues that the department was wrong. She never argued that there was no physical injury. She never argued that the tying was not used for discipline. She never argued in the briefs that those kids were not actually abused or any other reason that she should not have been indicated for this finding. And in any case, the department correctly determined that Powers was indicated for a violation of harm number 14, and she was found to have committed child abuse. Now, let's start with the facts here, and as you pointed out, they are all undisputed that Powers was in charge of that classroom. She led those kids to the chair to be tied up, knew what was going to happen, and she stayed there with them while they did. Those are all factual findings that the ALJ and the department made, and according to the standard of review, they're presumed prima facie true and correct. They're entitled to deference. Then, very importantly, let's also look at Section 300, Appendix D of the Administrative Code. And that's the preamble to the indicated findings. In the preamble, it says here, and just excuse me, I'm going to read from the statute very briefly. The preamble states that the harm alleged must have been caused by the acts or omissions of the person in question, Ms. Powers. Now, that's broad enough to encompass Ms. Powers' tying of these kids to the chair, or role, excuse me, in tying these kids to the chair, whether or not she actually tied the knot. It's at the very least an omission on her part where she was in a position to stop the tying and did not do it. So, first, her conduct is within allegation number 14, which we know is the tying of a child that unreasonably restricts mobility and, you know, by tying them to a fixed object here in the chair. And that's exactly what happened. She admitted to the inspector, Mr. Loy, that she actively participated in that process, even though she didn't tie the knot. The evidence showed that as the teacher in charge of that classroom, she played an indispensable role because she started the process. She led the kids to the chair to be tied up, and she stayed there with them while it happened. And what I think is an extremely important factual finding that was made here, in the investigator's report, which is part of the record, that tells us that the investigators and ultimately the department found that Ms. Powers was present and aiding Hill when the kids were tied up and would try to keep each child in the chair while Hill tied up. And those are pages of the impounded records, 71, 74, and 77, as to each of the children at issue.
Attorney Neumeister, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, you go first.
Here's my question. We heard from Attorney Smith, and he was saying basically a strict interpretation of this. No participation in the physical act of tying. And what you just referred to was a finding that says that she assisted or aided. So how do we resolve that?
Well, the finding that the ALJ, the department, the investigator, the finding that they actually made is based on the evidence that they heard in the case. And the way we resolve it is, first of all, is within the standard of reviews that we've been talking about, Justice Hackett. It's a factual finding, so it's presumed, first of all, to be prima facie true and correct. And also, the factual findings are reviewed in the course of your review of this case under the manifest weight of the evidence standard. That's how we're reviewing the factual findings. The ultimate determination of the violation and whether her conduct was reasonable, that, as counsel was correct in pointing out, that's a clear error standard. But as the factual findings we're talking about, the underlying factual findings, that's manifest weight. They're presumed prima facie true and correct and entitled to deference.
I understand. I think I should phrase it this way. Attorney Smith was arguing it doesn't matter that the finding says she assisted. The language of the allegation speaks to a direct action by Ms. Powers. So is there an inconsistency here that Attorney Smith is saying it really doesn't matter because it requires her physical act?
No, I don't think there's an inconsistency in our position because she was in charge of the classroom. And, you know, if I can direct you back to the preamble to these findings, it's that the harm alleged must have been caused by the acts or omissions of the person in question. And it's too much of a literal interpretation to say that because Powers didn't tie the knot, actually, you know, pull the strings on the bow or however they did it, that's far too much of a literal interpretation.
So let me interrupt you there to piggyback, because this was my line of questioning as well. Is there case law that gives us guidance about how we are to interpret these allegations? Are we to strictly interpret them, liberally interpret them? Can you cite any case law that gives the court guidance?
Not guidance with respect to this particular allegation. The best I can do right now in terms of legal authority is getting back to the standard of review. and how what you review is the department's decision, and reviewing the department's factual findings, which I've been discussing here, is presuming that they're prima facie true and correct, and there's been nothing presented here to establish that they were not. They should not be prima facie true and correct, that they were somehow against the manifest weight of the evidence, that Powers aided. Now, we don't know what aiding means in this particular factual context, because I wish we had a video of this so we could see. But based on the evidence that the department, the ALJ, heard and the investigator found, they made the finding that Powers aided in this tying. Now, we don't know if it was a bow tie. Did she place her finger while they tied the knot? But also kept the children in place there. We don't know if that was holding. We don't know if that was some other sort of restraint that she used, or if she just stood there and because of her authority over the children, they complied and sat to be tied.
We could get back to just the Sholich question about any case authority to help us answer this question in terms of how we are to interpret the statute in light of the allegations, and you indicated there really is no on-point case authority with respect to this particular allegation of harm. But let's, by analogy, and I don't know if this is a good analogy, but a situation where there's two parents involved in physical abuse of a child, and one parent is the one causing the act, and the other is allowing it to happen. Is there a case authority that discusses how that should be charged in terms of, would that be sufficient to simply say that each parent was involved in causing the physical harm to the child, even though one didn't actually cause the physical act of hitting the child? Do you follow me?
I do follow you, and if we don't know any more than that factual scenario and what each parent was actually doing, I would say, yes, that's enough to charge them both. And to get there, I have to go back to the preamble to the Administrative Code, which says that the allegation or the alleged harm must have been caused by the acts or omissions of the person in charge. So I think you could construe that to be if somebody like Powers or any other authority figure was in a position to stop the conduct, it's an act of, it's
an act of omission. Doesn't DCFS have a number of allegations at its disposal to essentially charge individuals? Risk of physical harm, environment injurious, I can think of three or four right off the top of my head. There's sort of some catch-all ones, and then there's some narrower ones. Isn't it similar to what Justice Hackett mentioned and what Mr. Smith mentioned? It's an element almost of a crime. And are we to strictly interpret those elements, or is there some guidance somewhere that tells us that we can liberally construe? That's what I'm trying to understand with these different allegations.
Well, to get to the point of why DCF picked this particular allegation,
yeah. The
record doesn't tell us. And I'd be doing everyone, including my client and your honors, a disservice if I stood here and tried to speculate as to why they picked this one as opposed to another one. Because the record's silent on that point, and I don't want to mislead anyone or misrepresent anything that my client did.
Well, that's kind of extraneous to our review here. Isn't it odd that the physical perpetrator of the act wasn't charged the same as Ms. Powers?
Well, Ms. Hill also, she had the same indicated finding. And she went through an administrative appeal as well. She's just not part of this particular appeal. She didn't take it this far, as far as we know.
She had administrative finding as to physical abuse of the child on a different incident. And then they permitted an expungement. Here, I'm going to get into another area, if you don't mind. This is way off of what you anticipate being asked here.
I like those types of questions.
Well, you might not like this. I looked at this and I was troubled by some elements of the administrative judge's order. So let's make sure we're on the same page. Our review here, you refer to it as we're reviewing the department. I don't think we're reviewing the department. We're reviewing a decision made by the director effectively adopting ALJ's decision.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Can we look then at the ALJ's decision and judge whether it is sufficient or deficient?
That's ultimately what we're doing here, and
this is what I want to say. If you look at this decision, I have a lot of concerns about the decision, and we're really not getting into them, and you really didn't address many of them in the brief, and so Attorney Smith has a chance here. But I think it is, in some ways, an issue that I have to consider, is that when I look at the order from the ALJ, it's not clear that there were findings on the ultimate issue for Ms. Bowers. I'm not sure there's evidence. I'm not sure that the decision addresses the requirement of sufficiency of the evidence or the evidence, and it concerned me. The paragraphs are, the evidence of the hearing did not establish that any of the children were injured. So we know that, not alleged. And then he cites the school code that says, this type of behavior carries a risk to the health and safety of the students and staff. But then the conclusion struck me as extremely broad. It says, based on the foregoing, the department has established that the children were placed at a substantial risk of physical injury, which would likely cause death, disfigurement, impairment of physical or emotional health, et cetera, et cetera. He finds that the department also has to determine that it is unreasonable and only cites the fact that because if they were tied, that it is against the law of the state of Illinois to tie such a child, so therefore it's unreasonable. Ultimately, when you read the decision, he limits himself to the point that the act must be found to impair the physical or emotional health, a substantial risk that would likely impair the physical or emotional health, but there's no such finding in the order.
And I want to give you a complete answer, but I see I'm running low on time.
Take the time, please.
Okay. I think to completely answer your question, Justice Hackett, we need to make sure what two different separate issues we're talking about. First, we're talking about the indicated finding and whether she engaged in the act or omission of time that we've been talking about. The second issue that has to be found for the child abuse, indication to go through is that the children were abused. And that's really what your question is getting at, I believe, that second issue. And whether they qualified as abused children and Powers as a perpetrator under the act. That's the second part of the Shivlock analysis that we have to go through. She was a responsible person under the act because she qualified as educational personnel responsible for their welfare while they were in her class. And her participation in aiding in the act of time.
I think we're still not connecting on the point.
Okay.
So I'll try to rephrase it.
Okay.
What evidence was presented or found in the report that demonstrates a substantial risk likely to cause impairment of physical or emotional health?
Okay, that is a factual finding that the director made, that there was, first of all, we don't have to have actual physical injury. We just have to have a substantial risk of injury likely to impair their physical or emotional health and a heightened risk of that injury. There was findings that the director made that those were autistic and nonverbal kids, and so they were at a heightened risk of injury that included psychological harm, and because they were nonverbal.
So without evidence, the finding itself is sufficient. What I'm saying is there's no reference to any evidence that it presented the factually required substantial risk of limited to emotional health.
Well, I have one more comment to make on that. It's that there were factual findings made, and it's undisputed the kids were autistic and they were nonverbal. And because they were nonverbal, they couldn't express whether there was any type of, they were in any type of pain, discomfort, experienced any type of injury. But we do know that they had very negative reactions, at least two of them did, when they were tied to the chair. One of them cried. Another one made, and Ms. Barnett described it as dolphin noises. It indicated that they were in distress when they were tied.
But he makes no finding that that satisfies these requirements. If I have a grandchild and put him in a car seat and it cries, is that abuse? Or does that give me basis to say that its emotional health has been endangered?
Well, I get back to the fact that these are findings that the director made, that based on the evidence that we've been discussing here, they were at a substantial risk of an injury that could have resulted in psychological harm because of their disabled state and because they were outwardly expressing distress about being tied to the chair. And that's under the standard of review here, that accepting the director's factual findings based on this evidence, that the factual findings were true and correct. Now, if we get on to the ultimate determination that there was child abuse, that's the manifest weight standard because how these facts apply to whether they were abused children. And indeed they do, as we've talked about, especially because Power's role as educational personnel responsible for their health and welfare. And she can't avoid any responsibility for this just because she didn't actually pull the string that tied the knot. But the key is those findings that she aided in that process and kept the children in place while Hill tied the knot. Those are entitled to deference. And based on that and her position within the classroom as educational personnel, and because of, as the director pointed out, the disabled, autistic, nonverbal nature of these children, that's sufficient to show that the department did not clearly err in what it did. No clear indication that a mistake had been made. I have exhausted my time and my comments, unless there's anything else you'd like to talk about.
Any further questions, Justice Bollinger? Any further questions?
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for your time and attention, Your Honors.
Mr. Smith, rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice. Just a couple points. Happy to answer any questions. Counsel mentioned that, the omission, what did Renee Powers do that might have been an omission? Without counsel saying anything very specific about an omission, but I think I'm hearing that when he references an omission, he might be referring to Ms. Powers not acting as a mandatory reporter and reporting Amy Hill for time. Okay. Well, someone else did that for us. That was the omission that was being referenced. But
I think the omission counsel was referring to was not intervening and stopping this from happening.
Not again. Well, that's a failure of intervention type of allegation. I mean, if this were a Section 1983 case in federal court against a police agency, we'd be talking about failure to intervene. But I guess that's not really part of the case. That's before us, omissions.
I mean, why is that not part of the case? Your client was in charge of this classroom. The aide worked under her direction. Why did she not have the authority to intervene and stop this? And why is that not an omission under the Act?
Well, it's not an omission under the Act because she wasn't actually charged with an omission under the allegation cited by DCFS. It's not part of the record. It's not part of the law of this case. She wasn't cited for that.
Counsel, I asked the question of Mr. Neumeister.
Yeah.
And you raised the point that there are a number of allegations that DCFS could have charged.
Right.
Her, and they chose allegation 14, and that's what's before this court. Is there case law that interprets any of the allegations and tells or directs the court how we are to construe these allegations, whether it's strict interpretation, whether it's liberal? You have any case law to support your position that strict interpretation is appropriate?
Well, that's a great question, and I couldn't find a case that said that an appellate court is that has to strictly construe the language in the allegation. But I think it's clear that when this court looks at the record, you will see that her conduct, it didn't meet the allegations of the definition. And what has happened at DCFS and at the lower court, there's been an impermissible expansion of the definition of the allegation to include conduct that's not in the definition of the allegation. I think we have enough here for the court to make a ruling. I couldn't find my definition of abuse, but it's at 325 ILCS 5-3 in the Abuse and Neglect of Child Reporting Act. An abused child means a child whose parent or immediate family member or any person responsible for child's welfare or any individual residing in the same home inflicts or causes to be inflicted or allows to be inflicted upon such child physical injury by other than accidental means, which causes death, disfigurement, impairment of physical, emotional health, or loss of impairment of any bodily function, or creates a substantial risk of physical injury to such child by other than accidental means, which will likely be cause death, disfigurement, impairment of physical, emotional health, or loss of impairment of any bodily function. In this case, that's a stretch for what happened. There's been no findings of fact. The administrative law judge's findings of facts are contained in the record on page CI-37. The only thing he says about Renee Powers is that she was a teacher at Brightside Academy in Paris, Illinois, during the 2023-2024 school year. That's the only finding that he makes against my client, that she was a teacher at the academy. He makes no specific finding of fact that she did anything that either triggered a violation of Allegation 14 or was abuse under the Act. And that's in the record on page CI-37. The administrative law judge made no finding of fact that Renee Powers ran afoul of Allegation Number 14 or violated ANCRA abuse. So when my client came to court, she expected the court and administrative law judge to apply the law of the case, not to expand it to include other things that we weren't litigating. And she's been harmed by this. She's had no professional mobility. And she already is a teacher in a small rural community with very limited professional opportunities. And now that she's been deemed a child abuser, she can't find any other employment. She can't substitute teach in any other schools. Her earning has been impaired. It's a very, very sad situation to say that teachers who would use a pair of polka dot leggings to stop children from running out of the classroom or climbing up on furniture to injure themselves are child abusers. Quite frankly, it's offensive. Thank you.
All right. Any questions?
Well, just as to that last point, didn't the ALJ make a finding of fact that there was no evidence indicating any child posed a safety risk necessitating being tied? Wasn't that one of the findings?
Your Honor, I'm going to read. No, that was not one of the findings of fact. I'll read the findings of fact to you here. They're contained on page CI-37 of the record. It is within the province of the administrative law judge to determine the credibility of witnesses, resolve disputed questions of fact, and draw reasonable inferences from the evidence.
Let me just put it another way, since we're running out of time. Was there any evidence that any of these children were posing any safety risk at the time or necessitating that they be tied up?
My recollection of the case, because I've had this case for a while, Your Honor, was that there was one student, I think it was EP, that would climb on the furniture. There was another student who was nonverbal who didn't take verbal, that was EP, he didn't take verbal instruction. So you had to physically, get him in a situation where he was safe. These teachers, they're put in a very, very complicated situation where they have to make immediate snap decisions. They are not paid well, and to have this happen to them is extremely difficult. Based on these facts.
Thank you. Any questions, Justice Hackett?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your arguments. We will take this matter under advisement. We will issue a ruling in due course.
Thank you.
Have a great rest of your day.